Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Notre-Dame de Paris is a huge and very famous Catholic cathedral found in the heart of the French capital, Paris, and is one of the city's very many great monuments. In fact, of the 52 monuments that we're going to cover as part of this series this year, not only does France, the country, have more of them than any other country, with six in total, five of those French monuments are in Paris itself, meaning that it, by itself as a city, has more than any other country on the entire list. We'll get to the others, the other Parisian monuments in due course. One's actually coming up next week, in fact. But today, we're going to talk about Paris's most famous church, which has stood for almost 1,000 years. Construction began on Notre-Dame de Paris in 1163, and it was completed almost 100 years later in 1260. Building a cathedral of this size and splendour was not a swift undertaking. I think it's that much is very obvious. The church itself, the cathedral, it was built on the location of previous places of worship, previous churches, previous temples even. Prior to Notre-Dame, there stood the Cathedral of Saint-Étienne. That was what was on the site there. And before the Cathedral of Saint-Étienne, it's very likely we think there was a temple to the Roman god Jupiter. So it's been a place that people have been going to worship their gods for a very, very long time indeed. But ultimately, the Cathedral of Saint-Étienne was demolished to make way for a bigger church in the 12th century. This old cathedral, the Cathedral of Saint-Étienne, was just simply not big enough for Paris's growing population. And so under the authority of the Bishop of Paris, a bloke named Maurice de Sully, construction began on Notre Dame, as I say, in 1163. Pope Alexander III and King Louis VII were both there in attendance as the cathedral's cornerstone was placed. It was a big bloody deal, let me tell you. Over the next century, construction continued on this church in four stages. The cathedral was built in the Gothic style, replacing the Romanesque style of the Cathedral of Saint-Étienne. And Notre Dame has since come to be recognized as the best and certainly the most famous example of a Gothic style cathedral. There are plenty of famous cathedrals built in the Gothic style, sometimes called the French style, particularly not in France. Salisbury Cathedral in Britain, Cologne Cathedral in Germany, Reims Cathedral, another French cathedral. But I would say that above all of these, Notre Dame remains quite comfortably the best known of all of them. Anyway, as I say, from 1163 to 1260, builders toiled away at the construction site, slowly but steadily putting together this magnificent cathedral. And in doing so, there are a few aspects in its design that made this structure a very innovative, or honestly, almost revolutionary piece of architecture. Specifically, the use of both rib vaults and the very excitingly named flying buttress made Notre Dame Cathedral quite unique in its construction and certainly more advanced than any building like it that had gone before. Now, as the son of an architect, I don't know if I've ever mentioned this fact on the show before, but my dad is indeed an architect. As the son of an architect, I'll do my best to explain these architectural concepts to you here. But I will say before attempting this, I will mention I have two distinct disadvantages in trying to do so. Firstly, as this podcast lacks a visual component, it does make it a little difficult to describe architectural elements, elements that would be a lot easier to conceptualize and understand with, you know, a picture or a drawing of them. But still, I'll do my best. But the other disadvantage is, secondly, as I say, I'm the son of an architect. My dad designs buildings for a living, and this, it may surprise you, actually does put me at a disadvantage when trying to talk about architecture. Why, you may wonder? Because, oh my goodness, I can't tell you how many times when I was a kid that my dad would talk me through the drawings he was working on with his Artline, you know, 0.4 fineliners, enthusiastically bringing my attention to, you know, the architraves and the cantilevers, showing me elevations and isometrics, and until I felt like I bloody knew AutoCAD and Autodesk Revit better than he did. And rather than these little sessions with my old man being instructive, they were instead incredibly soporific. They were so boring. But of course, the last thing that I wanted to do was disappoint my old man. So I just had to sort of smile and nod and get through him without, you know, breaking his heart with what I thought was very obvious disinterest. I don't know if my feigned interest ever actually convinced him, but I tell you what, it's left me with a lifelong aversion to architectural terminology. And whenever I visit my old man, even today, I have to be very, very careful about chatting about his work, lest I'm dragged back into A1 plotted sheets filled with schematic designs and site plans and building sections. Sorry, Dad. Sorry, mate. Honestly, look, I love you very much, but oh man, your job is so boring. I don't know how you do it. Anyway, sorry, yes, let's talk about the revolutionary use of certain architectural elements in Notre Dame, and I'll do my very best to stay awake while going through it all. Firstly, rib vaults. Rib vaults had been around for a long time before Notre Dame. They are quite simply the diagonal arches that crisscross a large open space inside many old buildings. They make curved X shapes along a ceiling, essentially. They curve down to join columns or pillars beneath them, which bear the weight load of the roof materials above. So rib vaults are, at their most basic, a very, very effective way to build large, high-ceilinged rooms without the weight of the roof above crashing down. Compare and contrast a rib vault with instead a barrel vault, a single arch-like curve that creates an almost tunnel-like roof. You'll find these in much older buildings, and barrel vaults aren't as effective as bearing weight downwards into columns or pillars or even into the walls that may be below them. They actually push the weight outwards as well as downwards, meaning that you can't have a very heavy roof unless you have very, very thick walls. So rib vaults have the advantage of, while they do still bear weight outwards, unlike a barrel vault, rib vaults bear most of their weight down. They press downwards into the columns and the pillars that are beneath them, rather than the thick walls that you need to keep a barrel vault up. So you may be wondering, well, what's the advantage of this? Why does this make a building better to not have weight being borne to the side rather than straight down? Well, it means, right, that you don't only get to use thinner walls because you're not having the walls bear as much weight. You can bear a lot of that weight on columns and pillars. It also allows you to build higher ceilings, right? Because the ceilings are held more strongly by a network or a grid of pillars and columns in between, in the middle of an open space, right? Whereas with a barrel vault, you've only got supportive structures on either side of it. So the weight of a ceiling or a roof, which, you know, obviously is going to be very, very heavy, particularly when you're working with stone, is dispersed across a greater area without thick walls getting in the way. So again, you might be wondering what the advantage of that is. We'll come to it in a minute, but just remember, thinner walls, fewer walls, columns and pillars, very high ceilings, right? The final result of this is a larger and grander interior space that is, most importantly, filled with much, much more natural light. If you're really interested, right? If you're really interested in this, go online, find some pictures, and compare how much natural light there is in a barrel-vaulted church compared with a church with rib vaults. Higher ceilings, thinner walls, fewer walls means there is more space for windows, which means a lighter and therefore much more impressive interior. And Notre Dame, it put rib vaults to use like never before, resulting in an incomprehensibly high ceiling for the time, and more windows, more natural light than anyone had ever seen inside a church of this size before. These days, very easy for us to take something like this for granted. These days, we can build entire buildings out of glass, basically. But walking into such a massive building back then and not feeling like you were inside a large, gloomy cave would have been such an overwhelming experience for people at the time. But I mentioned that rib vaults still put outward pressure on external walls, and indeed they do. So why are the walls of Notre Dame not heavy and thick to support that weight? How have they managed to make these walls so thin? Because the cathedral also makes innovative use of the flying buttress, which, like most architectural elements, is a lot less exciting than it sounds. A regular buttress, a buttress that doesn't fly, I guess, a terrestrial buttress, this is just a support that is built against an exterior wall. You'll sometimes see them on old buildings, sometimes on great big dams. They're often sort of wedge-shaped with their thicker end towards the bottom, and then they taper up towards the top. So that's a regular buttress. A flying buttress, on the other hand, is a buttress that is like an arch, or like half an arch, really, coming up out of the ground and leaning against the wall with a space beneath it, but a space between the buttress itself and the wall that it's supporting. So if you go and have a squiz at a picture of Notre Dame, you'll notice all along the outside walls, right around it, except on the, check this out, you ready? Except on the west elevation. How about that one, Dad? I was listening. After all those years, I was listening. On the west elevation, there are no flying buttresses. But right around the other walls, the other sides of the building, are enormous flying buttresses supporting the exterior walls. They're huge. They really are. And these flying buttresses allowed the rib-vaulted ceilings to be even higher than ever before, because the exterior walls, right, are built to support the weight of an even higher ceiling without being built too thick. A flying buttress also, because, you know, has most of a flying buttress is just air, the gap underneath the buttress itself, because of this, even more light can come in through windows. It doesn't get to a point where the sun's in the sky where the buttress is blocking sunlight from entering the window. So another revolutionary aspect of architecture that allowed more natural light to enter a massive building like Notre Dame. You might be thinking, right, at this point, bloody hell, this guy's going on about natural light a fair bit, right? But I do want you to appreciate the significance of this, right? More windows, more natural light means a more impressive and more magnificent interior. Artificial lighting, back when Notre Dame was built, was nowhere near the standard that we'd expect today. And it's not as if, you know, today we have great big bright electric lights that can light up the night like it's day, but it wasn't even lighting up the night back then. It was lighting up the day. You walk into old buildings, they're gloomy, they're stuffy, they've only got very limited amount of light coming in from the inside. And the flicker of torchlight or candles or even fire pits or whatever else you're using to illuminate the inside of a building, we don't really realize this these days. Fire doesn't give off that much light, particularly compared to the electric lights that we have today. I think we sort of think, oh, you know, it's more or less the same, right? We just use electricity because it's more convenient. No, fire doesn't give off as much light as, anywhere near as much light as an electric light would. And so getting natural light into a building of this size prevented it from feeling, as I said before, like just a great big gloomy cave. So it really was revolutionary. And if you're still not convinced by the importance of natural light, even today with artificial light dominating the way that we live our lives, if you're still not convinced, if you're wondering just how important natural light can possibly be in deciding how attractive and impressive a building's interior is, go online and have a look at the relative house prices, even these days, that have expansive light field in Australia, northern elevations, right? These houses sell for a lot more than houses whose windows primarily face south, purely because more light enters the house if its windows face north. In the southern hemisphere, of course, the opposite is true in the northern hemisphere, where south-facing windows receive more light. But the principle is the same. The more natural light a building can take in, the nicer that it will generally be considered by people. Anyway, between the rib vaults and the flying buttresses, Notre Dame was unlike any cathedral that had been built before. It was larger, grander, and most importantly, lighter with heaps of windows letting heaps of light in. And speaking of windows, Notre Dame also very quickly became famous for its massive circular stained glass windows called rose windows. You may have seen these. They're one of the most famous parts of the cathedral. There are three rose windows at Notre Dame, still there today. There are rose windows on the north, south, and western elevations. Massive, exquisite stained glass windows. Again, one of the most famous aspects of the whole building. And built in the 13th century, right, these windows are massive, like people have never seen before. The western one is just under 10 meters in diameter, while the north and south windows are almost 13 meters across. But they're not the only famous decorative element of Notre Dame. Far from it, in fact. The entire cathedral is, as you know, as is typical for a Catholic church, richly decorated. Statues, sculptures, carvings, all sorts of other things. And interestingly, the reasoning behind the existence of many of these decorations isn't just decorative. A lot of these decorations are also meant to be, if you'll believe it, instructional as well. Because think about this, right? Back in the 13th century, when the cathedral first opened, the overwhelming majority of the people who visited were illiterate. They couldn't read. So these sculptures and statues were actually designed to illustrate scenes and stories from the Bible, the Bible that people wouldn't otherwise have access to. They couldn't read this this book for themselves. Additionally, as well as these decorative sculptures and statues trying to, you know, tell you a story, some of them were actually very functional in their purposes, as in addition to obviously being decorative. Specifically, the huge number of gargoyles that adorn the building. They've been designed to funnel rainwater away from the walls so as to protect the masonry from erosion. You know, these days we obviously use gutters and downpipes and whatever else, but back then they just sculpted weird, scary monsters and had the water pour out of their mouths onto the ground below. Anyway, long story short, the cathedral is an architectural masterpiece, ornately decorated, immense and impressive, a grand, imposing building that set a new standard in church building practices. And it stuck around all this time through to the present day, although, as you may know, it has also had its fair share of trials and tribulations over the years. Some pretty minor in the grand scheme of things, others, as you may in fact remember, some posing an almost existential threat to the entire building itself. So let's whiz through the building's history here. After becoming an instant marvel once it was finished, attracting visitors from far and wide, Notre Dame actually began to feel dated after a century or two. In the 15th century, many of the internal Gothic-style decorations within the cathedral were actually covered up by tapestries to disguise an architectural style that was no longer in fashion. These days we look at it and we think, you know, it's exquisite. It's an incredible example of medieval Gothic architecture. But you get to the Renaissance and people think, oh, geez, this is a bit out of fashion, isn't it? This is a bit dated. Sort of like these days, you know, you might give a daggy old brick bungalow a glow up by rendering the exterior, I guess. But it wasn't just the shifting fashions of the centuries that caused some pretty significant changes to Notre Dame. In the 16th century, Notre Dame came under attack, actual physical attack from French Protestants, the Huguenots. Protestants aren't generally fans of great big lavish places of worship, and so in 1548 rioting Protestants went after the cathedral. They destroyed many of its statues, much of its decoration. But it wasn't all bad news. Over the centuries, the cathedral grew its collection of artworks and artifacts, most of which were donated by wealthy patrons. Many of them are still there today. And additionally, in the 18th century, work was done to modernize the church, to protect and strengthen its structure, and allow even more light in with the replacement of much of the medieval glass with newer, more modern, much, much clearer glass. However, the rose windows, I'm happy to say, they were left alone, with the exception of some of the southern rose window. It had suffered some damage and required restoration. But broadly speaking, the rose windows today, as they looked, you know, almost 1,000 years ago. But to bring it back to damage and stuff that wasn't necessarily great for the cathedral, Did the cathedral do well for itself during the French Revolution? No, it did not. French revolutionaries were not, generally speaking, the biggest fans of organized religion. And look, while I'm certainly on board with them in that respect, I don't appreciate what they did to poor old Notre Dame. Because even being irreligious, that doesn't prevent me from appreciating great works of religious art and architecture or music or whatever else, right? And I'm sorry to say that the cathedral was heavily damaged and badly plundered by these godless revolutionaries. Statues were destroyed, treasures were looted, Notre Dame was not in a good way at all. At one point, it was actually used by the revolutionaries to store things. It was used as a warehouse. Anyway, along comes Napoleon, episodes 211, 212 get across him. He comes to power. He made efforts to restore the cathedral. He was, in fact, coronated there as the Emperor of the French. But much of his redecoration was done in the neoclassical style, not in the Gothic style, which was very popular at the time. And while today you sort of may conflate old architectural styles, the Gothic style, very, very different from the neoclassicist style. Just go and have a look at most famous old public buildings in the United States built around this time. Neoclassicism was very much the style du jour around the turn of the 19th century. And much of the work Napoleon did kind of stuck out like a sore thumb on what was otherwise, a classic example of medieval Gothic architecture. However, once Napoleon was off the scene, unfortunately, it went from bad to worse. Notre Dame fell into disrepair. People broadly lost interest in the upkeep of the cathedral. And in fact, plans began to be made to demolish Notre Dame altogether, as it really wasn't in good nick. It was saved, luckily, however, by someone you may have heard of. It was saved by none other than Victor Hugo, the famous author, the author of Les Mis, of course, Les Miserables, and of course, also The Hunchback of Notre Dame, which was published in 1831 and single-handedly revived public interest in the cathedral. And all of a sudden, the French government is investing money in the repair and the restoration of the church. And in particular, these restoration efforts sought to return the church to its original Gothic style as much as possible. Although it seems like they couldn't help themselves when it came to adding a great big spire. An enormously tall spire or flesh was added in the mid-19th century, 96 metres tall at its top. Although, as we'll come to, that particular flesh is no longer there these days. Anyway, even with all this restoration work, the cathedral wasn't out of the woods. It was in much better shape than it had been for a great many years. But then in 1871, the short-lived Paris Commune closed all of the churches and the cathedrals in the city and planned to burn Notre Dame to the ground. However, luckily, once again, it was saved, this time by the fact that there was a hospital next door to it, and they were worried that the hospital might also burn down if they set fire to the church, and so it was granted a stay of execution. And as we move into the 20th century now, Notre Dame did suffer some minor damage when Paris was liberated from the Nazis in 1944. It then underwent a very thorough cleaning in the 1960s to get rid of the grime and the dirt of the ages and return the cathedral to its original off-white, a colour it has not held on to, given just, the general air quality in a massive bustling city like Paris. But I'm sure, as many listeners will remember, one of the greatest threats to the cathedral's ongoing existence came along very, very recently, in the 21st century, in 2019, just 5 years ago, when a great fire tore through much of the cathedral, destroying the flesh, the spire, as well as most of the old wooden roof beams as well, and causing 750 tons of metal roofing and stone walls to come crashing down. In addition to that, the cathedral also suffered extensive water damage as a result of the firefighters who were, desperately working to save the building. But we're not going to blame them too much for that, I reckon. They were doing their best to save the building as a whole. So a bit of water damage, an acceptable loss, I would say. Work began on repairing the damage caused by the fire almost immediately and is still underway today at time of recording. The new flesh was finished in 2023, just last year, while massive oak beams that have been earmarked to replace the ones that were destroyed are currently drying They're currently curing before they can actually be used to restore the roof to its former state. Great big oak trees were felled across France, and the wood was taken and has been being prepared for the last couple of years, in fact, before they can actually install it in the church. And as part of this massive ongoing restoration effort, architects and engineers and builders from all around the world are working together to restore the cathedral, although sadly, it does seem that my dad was overlooked, unfortunately. He's more in the realm of, you know, modern commercial fit-outs than medieval cathedrals. But look, the work continues, and at the time of recording, they have the aim of reopening the church by the end of this year, by December 2024. And hopefully, this target is met. And hopefully, one of the world's great monuments is once again thrown open to the public. And also, hopefully, that is the last major ordeal this poor old cathedral has to go through. Hopefully the next 1,000 years of its existence will be a little less fraught with danger and destruction compared to the first 1,000.